Well, reading is one of the fundamentals of an education. I mean, how can you even research if you don't really read? And motivated reading, especially for the young, is the way to get there. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. We are back for our annual visit with this year's Spirit of Reading author. Will Hobbs readers are standing by to call, and you can too at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Spirit of Reading author Will Hobbs talks to his readers and us today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, in our past editions of Spirit of Reading, it's a book club kind of show, basically, except that Spirit of Reading has already seen to it that people read the book, because that was the problem we would have. We would announce a book club, said, oh, let's all try and read this book, and then come the show and we get the author on and everything, and nobody calls who's read the book. So it turns out that Spirit of Reading took care of that problem by circulating a whole lot of copies of the books and then bringing the author up to meet the kids. And so the kids had plenty of questions having read the book. And so we've done this for, I guess this will be the third time around, maybe the fourth. And we usually get a bunch of participation from school libraries and kids who have read these books in the Spirit of Reading program. And the program is just really a volunteer thing. It was started in Sitka, and it's involves school librarians basically promoting a certain author's books. And then they not only circulate the books, but bring the author up for the kids to meet the author. And the author this time around is a fellow by the name of Will Hobbs. He's got a bunch of Alaska experience. He lives in Colorado, but joins us today from Tucson, Arizona. Will, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Steve, it's great to be with you and your listeners. I'm wearing an Alaska T-shirt for the occasion. Walk softly and carry a big fish.
Yeah, you. So I know that you have already done your school library tour up here. That was earlier, right?
Yes, that was in that was last fall, a Ketchikan, and then Sitka, and then Juneau, and that was visits both at the public libraries and at the schools. So I met a whole lot of readers in Southeast and just had a great time. Ran into Rachel, the T-shirt artist, of course.
Oh, yes.
There's something fishy about that man.
To say the least. Yeah, he's been on the show, and as you might imagine, he's a great guest.
Oh, yeah, great guy.
Well, Will, you were also telling me that you actually spent time at Ellendorf years ago?
Oh, yeah. This is mid-50s. I was in fourth grade, fifth grade, Air Force kid. My dad was a civil engineer at Ellendorf, and I used to snag the salmon out of Ship Creek back in the day, and Dad would take us down to the Kenai, down to Cooper Landing and the Russian River. No combat fishing back in those days. So I grew up kind of imprinting on the Northern Lights and the rusting gold dredges and bears and the midnight sun and the whole thing. And we left on a Navy ship out of Kodiak, Whittier, and then Kodiak, January of 58, and man, the tears were just flowing as I was looking at Alaska receding in the distance. And so it took me a lot of years to get back, but the last 15 years or so, I've just been getting back all the time.
Yeah, I noticed that, because you're actually setting a bunch of books in Alaska. I saw there's one on the Yukon River. There's Leaving Protection. Mm-hmm. And I guess far north, Wildman Island, were the ones that I picked out.
Yeah, I've got five of them that are in the north per se. There are two of them actually on the Yukon River, and one's the historical novel on the Klondike Gold Rush with of course Jack London as one of the characters. The novel's mostly peopled by actual historical characters, Sophie Smith and Jack London and you name it. And there's a sequel to that one down the Yukon across the Canadian-Alaskan border on the heels of the Klondike. That one's called Down the Yukon, and it's about the rush to Nome in 1899. So I've got those two along the Yukon. Far north is in the NWT, and I had done a raft trip there, just my wife and I and a friend from Durango, Colorado, and when we were portaging the 385-foot waterfall on the South Nahanni River, I heard about a little incident that became the gist, you know, the little seed for that novel that became Far North. And then there's the fishing story, Leaving Protection, down in Southeast, with all the Russian history behind it that grew out of me working on a troller out of Prince of Wales Island. And then there's Wildman Island in Southeast that grew out of a sea kayak trip, a six-day sea kayak trip that my wife and I did along the shores of Chichagof.
Wow. Yeah, so it's not just, I had the feeling it was Southeast, and then I saw that Yukon River thing in there, and then you talk about the Northwest Territory. Now, that was probably a good idea to portage that waterfall.
That's Gene and I are whitewater rafters from way back, and we've taken our own raft through the Grand Canyon 10 times, and one time we were down in the Grand Canyon, we met some Canadians. We started talking about their Grand Canyon. We said, stop, you know, what are you talking about? And they said, it's called the South Nahanni, and it's got more than 100 miles of 3,000-foot deep canyons. And at one point, right where those canyons begin, this big river, the South Nahanni, pours over a waterfall that's twice as high as Niagara. They said, you got to go see it. So the very next summer we did. And, of course, I never would have... you know, I had the experience to write Far North or the desire to do all the research to write the winter story up there based on the native knowledge of what all the animals are doing in winter and so on. So that's the way I love to work, is a combination of personal experience and then research.
Now, I want to get back to this river running business. Have you run the Talkeetna yet?
I never have. But I got to tell you... the river that, you know, one of the, other than the Colorado, I think the great river of North America, as far as I know, is the Alsek, running from the Yukon Territory out to Dry Bay through the Wrangell-St. Elias, through all those incredible mountains and glaciers. And I was lucky enough to do that trip once, and I was in awe the entire 11 days.
Well, I am amazed when I go to your website, at the sheer number of books, Will Hobbs, that you've managed to turn out at your tender age.
Well, I don't know about that. I taught for 17 years, Steve, and I taught a little bit of high school and mostly middle school, and I didn't get serious about writing until I had been a classroom teacher for a number of years and kind of got hooked on the books that my students were reading, and a lot of them were outdoor books, and I thought I ought to try it myself. But I left my classroom in 1990 when I was working on my third one, and then I started to write a book a year for about 15 years, and somehow I was able to do that. But now I'm working on a contract where I'm doing a book every other year, and it's gotten harder. You know, I think maybe it's the Scheherazade syndrome, that you work better under pressure. I don't know.
Well, that, you know, I saw on your website that little tale about your... Do you still have that little wind-up dinosaur of yours?
I do. It's a pterodactyl. Yeah.
Now, go ahead and tell the story of how you do this, because we have a number of writers who listen to the show rather than write during this hour, as you might imagine.
Well, sometimes, you know, you just kind of freeze up there in front of your keyboard and your monitor, and nothing's happening, and it's kind of like you're trying to start your motor at 30 below and you've left your truck out in the cold, and the motor oil on your head is just like, you know, thick, and nothing's happening, and you realize you've been sitting there and you're not riding, and I've become convinced that unless your fingers are moving, you know, your brain, you can't really write, because the hand and the mind and the brain are connected. So if you just start writing any kind of nonsense, you just might drop into where you were in your story, and you'll just kind of kick it into gear, and you'll get the motor started. So if I realize I've been sitting there doing nothing for half an hour, and I'm just really stalled, I'll wind up my little pterodactyl, and it'll walk across my desk, and when it stops, I have to be writing.
So it's fingers to the keyboard by the time the critter gets across the desk.
Mm-hmm. That's the rule.
And it works.
And it seems to work. You know, you just gotta hang in there when it's not happening, but then you just gotta, you know, some days, you know, you might write a bunch, and other days it just might not really be happening, but unless you spend the time in the chair and actually try to make it happen, it's not gonna.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Email is talk@aprn.org, and we have some questions by email already. And let's see, did I say it was a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422? Our guest is Will Hobbs. He's author of numerous pieces of juvenile fiction and other works, as we're finding out. And he's on the phone from Tucson, Arizona. His books have been featured, several of them, in the Spirit of Reading program in school libraries across the state of Alaska. And we've invited, and the librarians are cooperating in having some questions come through from people who have actually read books by Will Hobbs. They include things like Leaving Protection, Wild Man Island, Far North, all of them set up in the North. But not all his books are set in the North. But they are, Will, are they not? They tend to be very outdoorsy and very adventuresome.
Very much so, Steve. That's really the vein that I try to tap, and what I'm hoping to do is connect with kids who really know the life and who've lived the life. You know, my Alaska readers are really special to me, but even kids who might live in urban areas in the east or south or who knows where, they can really connect, because, you know, reading is a real act of imagination, and imagining being that person who's in the story who's so different from you are, and you're finding yourself in a different world. And I think the connection with nature is so primal in human beings that whether or not somebody lives with access to it or not, to wild places, they can love to go there in their minds through reading.
I remember when I read the Bobbsey Twins, and I think that was the one. And then there was something after that. Oh, the Hardy Boys. That was the
Hardy
one.
Hardy Boys. Did you ever pick up those Jim Kelgard books?
Oh, yeah, all of them.
Like Big Red and Irish Red. I love those.
Yeah.
Those were in the outdoors.
You bet they are. Yeah, he was from Pennsylvania, up around where I come from, so we all got a good introduction to all those.
Bet you read Call of the Wild when you were a kid.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was a kick, writing the story with Jack London as one of the characters. And the stuff that I learned, now this is Jason Scoldham talking about, the stuff that I learned that he did during that year up in the North when he was 21 years old, you know, you never learn about that by reading one of his books, but it's just flat out phenomenal what he did up there.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, I might come back to that in a little bit, but I want to get on to some of these questions that have come in from the fifth grade class in Craig.
From
Julie Yates's fifth grade class has some questions for you, Will Hobbs. So you ready? Are you ready?
I am so ready.
All right. Let's start. And as you might imagine, poor protection would come into this a bit. It's kind of in the neighborhood there, isn't it?
It sure is. The protagonist of my story, Robbie Daniels, has grown up on a float house up there at Port Protection, up at the northern tip of Prince of Wales Island, up by Point Baker.
Yeah.
And he comes down at the beginning of the story. He's turned 16. He's grown up with a fishing family, But when he turns 16, he can go to work commercial as a deckhand and make some cash money for college. So he hops the bush plane down to Craig, and he meets a teacher on the dock down there. It's really less than 48 hours to go before the July 1 opening of King season. And everybody seems to have a deckhand. And he runs into this this teacher from Craig, Alaska, by the name of Julie Yates. Yeah, she's a real person, and I guess she's she and her students at Craig are down there about to ask me a question or two. And I wrote Julie and her son, Bear, and her dad, George Yates, who's a legendary fisherman down there out of Craig. I wrote them all into the novel in a cameo.
Ha ha! Well, all right then. So, what Julie has done is asked the kids to ask questions, and she typed them all into email. So, Here we go. And the first one comes from Aaron Johnson down in Craig, and he says, "Okay, what was your inspiration for leaving protection?" I think you partly answered that.
Yeah, Aaron, I could tell you that boat that's on the cover of the book. I sent, to make sure it was accurate and authentic, I sent a photograph to the artist of the troller that I worked on. And that art you're looking at on the cover of Leaving Protection, that is the boat that Julie grew up working on. Julie Yates started working at the age of 10 with her dad, George, out there on the outside water, outside of Prince of Wales. And that boat... is the real name of the boat is the Julie Christine. George named after his daughter Julie, your teacher. And I just renamed it the Storm Petrel because there's going to be a big old storm late in that story. And Robbie Daniels is going to be at the helm. And so I just named it after the bird, the Storm Petrel, because I wanted to get that word storm in some subliminal way on the cover of the book. So the inspiration for this book was the week I spent living the life out there during King season, one of the best in George Yates' lifetime, they had told me back then, and it was one of the greatest experiences of my life.
So what
that was the inspiration.
And that was a longline troller?
That is your troller with a... He's got the two arms, and you got your girdies working, and they're pulling up. You have four lines, two on each of those arms, with about a dozen lures on leaders off each of those four lines. So you're actually fishing for the kings down deep, generally about 150 feet, as I recall. And they're actually, they'll go for either the hoochies or brass spoons is what George was using. So you're actually, with the troller, you're catching the fish one at a time. Julie and her dad are working in the cockpit at the back of the boat. They're taking the leaders off of that thin steel line that has weighted by a cannonball. So they're taking the leader off, and if it's got a fish on it, they pull that leader in hand over hand. They lean over the back, and they conk that king on the head. And they throw it into the bin just right there by the cockpit where they're working. And then that's where I take over because I'm there cleaning fish all day. So that's what I love for this kind of boat. You're catching the fish one at a time. No nets involved and no long lines.
I gotcha. Yeah, well, that also answers Brian Castle's question from Craig, which is how did you get your ideas for Leaving Protection? I think we're covered on that one. Lexis Collins has a question for you, Will Hobbs. She says, what do you, I think it's a she, what do you think your next book will be on?
I'm glad you asked me that. It's going to be another one of my North books. I have to go back to the North every so often, and I've just had a book come out last month that's way down on the Texas-Mexico border on the Rio Grande. Below Big Bend National Park. That one's called Take Me to the River. So after I've done something down in a desert environment, I got to go back up and cool off. So this winter I'm working on a story. It's actually the second draft of a story that's going to be called Never Say Die. And that is the motto of a native village in the delta of the Mackenzie River up by the Beaufort Sea. And we're talking the very northwest tip of the Northwest Territories, right by the border with the Yukon Territory in Canada. And I had rafted the Firth River back in 2003, been wondering ever since if I might write a story about it that's set there one day. And this is a summer story set on the Firth River that I've been working on this winter. And cool. Boy, it's going to involve some wild weather, even though it's a summer story, because you can have real extremes up there in the Arctic, as I'm sure you know.
Yes.
At any time of the year.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to ask you this, Will Hobbs. I remember the problem I had with the Hardy Boys is that I didn't feel myself equal to either Frank or I forget what the other one's name was. Anyway, the two boys there, they were always a little bit more heroic than I would ever aspire to be. Do you write those kind of characters too?
Well, you know, a lot of times it's like there's another character in my story that might be the more heroic one, but the kid who's the main character, he's not so heroic. This one that just came out, Take Me to the River out in the Big Bend in Texas.
Uh-huh.
We got this kid from North Carolina who's always idolized his cousin. He's grown up out there in far west Texas, never met him. His cousin's named Rio, after the Rio Grande. And the boy from North Carolina finally goes out to meet him and do some paddling with him. And so this desert country out there, you know, it's so thorny and gnarly out there. Every rock and every plant is out to draw blood, you know. So he's the newcomer, and he's not nearly as gnarly as his cousin, and they're going to both be in these incredible conditions. There's a Black Hawk helicopter flying over on the cover of the story, and something is going on in Mexico where these six American Black Hawks have flown into Mexico. So that story's far north, to give you an example, the same way that this might work in one of my northern stories. I got a kid from San Antonio, Texas, who's up in Yellowknife, the capital of the Northwest Territories, terra incognita. Everything about the North is strange to this kid, so he's the narrator and the protagonist. And his roommate in the boarding school in Yellowknife is a native kid, a Dene Indian kid from, First Nations kid from Nahanni Butte, the native village that my wife and I visited at the end of our river trip on the South Nahanni. So the native kid is going to be from that country, but the narrator, you know, these two are going to be stranded way back in the woods in the wilderness on the verge of winter. But the kid from Texas who's stuck up there in the winter, man, he's not going to feel all that gnarly and heroic and courageous. It turns out that the native kid doesn't know all the things that he really needs to know to survive the winter in his own backyard. And that's what that story is about, is what the elders there in those villages call the need for a bush education on the part of their young people.
Well, you're certainly striking a resonant chord there, Will Hobbs.
It's going to be trying for both of them.
You got a lot to live up to on that, too, with Julia the Wolves, I assume you already know.
Oh, of course. Yeah, just a real classic back from back in my classroom library.
Yeah.
I had a lot of my students reading that one. And of course, I've met Gene Craighead George in my travels. There's so many great people, wonderful writers working in children's literature.
Well, I want to move north now up into the Juneau area where Mr. McKenna and fourth graders at Harborview Elementary are listening. And he's got Jackson, Nikki, Sahil, Graham, and Brandon with him. And he says, oh, gosh, you already answered our question about what's the inspiration for leaving protection. But we've been talking about the big question. So you ready for that one?
Let's have at it.
Okay, what is good writing? Would you like to take a shot at your answer to that question?
What is good writing?
Yeah.
Well, good writing has to grab the reader's emotions and the reader's mind. You know, it just has to put the reader right inside of the story. And that's what I think makes fiction so incredible. There's a lot of great nonfiction out there, and I read a lot of nonfiction for pleasure, like all the, you know, the history of the Klondike Gold Rush that I read for Jason's Gold. But there's something special about fiction, because there's nothing else that you know, invites the reader to imagine what it's like to be someone else. So as you're writing, you have to write with that kind of detail and with the kind of emotion that just kind of reaches out and it kind of has to photographically grab the reader like they're inside of a movie. You know, and when a kid tells me it felt like I was seeing a movie when you were describing, you know, when the motor died on that airplane that landed above the falls, and you could hear the falls getting louder and louder, and it was so terrifying. Well, what you're doing as a writer, you're putting the reader in that situation. And here's the big secret to writing, and here it goes from me to you, all those kids listening today, adults are interested in writing as well. Here's what you do. You write through the five senses of the reader. You avoid hitting them over the head. You know, don't tell the reader that the character is frightened. Don't say scared or use the word like fear. It's not wrong, but it's weak. You know, you try to avoid that, and it's just the sound of those falls getting louder and louder. As these two boys are out on the pontoons of that bush plane, as it's floating down to the falls, and the kids are yelling back and forth to each other, the kid from Texas and the native kid, you know, they're not going to make it, not going to make it, and the falls are getting louder. And you better believe me, the reader's going to feel the fear. So that's the secret, right through the five senses of the reader, and they are going to be there with you.
Great. Thanks a lot. We're talking with Will Hobbs, author of Leaving Protection and a number of others. You've been talking about his new book, which is, I guess, not unexpected. Ginny joins the program from Sitka. Ginny Blackson, I assume?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning, and congratulations on another winner.
Well, thank you very much. We did a little different this year. We had Will come in September. Usually our authors come in May. And so we had a wonderful fall visit to Sitka and Juneau and Ketchikan from Mr. Hobbs this year. And the program's not over yet. We're still circulating books around the state. And Will is going to do video conferences to students in the Southwest Region School District in April.
It's great to hear your voice, Jenny. I am really looking forward to that video conference, and I'm going to be able to tell those kids from those remote villages that I've been as close to where they live as Dillingham. Anyway, I've been out there King Salmon and fishing on the Alagnac River, and so I am really looking forward to that video conference.
And so the question I had for Mr. Hobbs was, when you came to Southeast and visited, did you find the reaction to your books different than when you had visited with students who weren't from Alaska? I think one of the examples I have is
we
did a reading group of Leaving Protection, and the kids were all that he should have never went on that boat without permission. they could not get past that.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, to answer your question, yes, it is very different meeting with kids from Alaska, and it's just absolutely the coolest. You know, visits like the ones that I did in Southeast last fall in Sitka and Ketchikan and Juneau, it does not get any better than that, because some of those kids will have even grown up in float houses. They've worked on commercial boats, you know. Some of their parents are commercial fishermen. Up at Floyd Dryden Middle School in Juneau, I actually had two teachers who were commercial fishermen, and they had their kids reading Leaving Protection, and they had all done the graphics of all the gear on the boat and everything about the trollers you know, it's just really special to write that kind of audience. And of course, when I'm writing that line where we were in Craig and Robbie Daniels, who knows better, he you know, at the time that he's describing that, he says he knew better, but he was just so excited. And he wondered what kind of gear this highliner fished with, and he was sure that the guy was away buying groceries. He wasn't around his boat, so he did something he should never have done. He goes on the boat, and that's when he accidentally picks up that tray with the lures, and he sees what turns out to be one of the rarest artifacts in all of the Americas. It's one of the missing plaques that the Russians buried around the shores of Alaska to lay claim to the land. And as you know, the only one that's ever been discovered was at the site of the original Russian fort north of Sitka. And this turns out to be what drives the novel. When the kid discovers the Highliner secret, the guy's actually like a modern pirate, and he's discovered what's essentially a treasure map. He knows where the other 19 plaques were buried, and here he's been digging them up. So he hires this kid who never should have been on the boat, but the kid has no idea why he's being hired. It's because he knows the fisherman's secret. So it is what drives the story. And a lot of times in books like mine, or just any kind of books, you know, there wouldn't be a story unless the character did something they shouldn't have done. It's like they shouldn't have done it. I've got a character in one of my books who plays what turns out to be a magic flute, you know, at this cliff ruin in the Southwest. Well, he has no idea that he shouldn't be doing this, but it turns out to be a magic flute, and he gets trapped in the body of a pack rat.
Okay.
I want to thank you, Will, for coming up and visiting with us. And, Steve, if your listeners want more information, we do still have our website up, akspiritofreading.com. And we haven't settled on next year's program, but we should have information up about it soon.
Okay.
Well, thanks for everything that you do, Jenny. It's just Spirit of Reading is just a fantastic program, and long may it live.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Jenny Blackson in Sitka. And we're with Will Hobbs, author of a number of books, and this year's Spirit of Reading author. And he's still involved in it, going to be doing teleconferences with Southwest Alaska. And I got a couple more questions yet from Julie Yates' class. I'll get to those as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust land owner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message sponsored by the Native American Trust. Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
It's Talk of Alaska. It's Spirit of Reading time again, as we do once a year, participate with the school librarians and the kids listening to these shows at school libraries and putting in questions for the author of the books that they've read. It's a book club show, but it's nice to deal with young readers who are just getting excited about the idea of reading and talking about the kind of books that do get young people highly engaged. So, Will Hobbs, I got a couple more from Julie Yates' class. And one of them is from Bella, who says, what was the first book you ever wrote?
The first book I ever wrote, it's called Bear Stone. And it's about a kid from Utah, from White Mesa, Utah. Now, this is a boy who's from the Ute Indian tribe. It has a really special connection with bears. And his grandmother hadn't been making him go to school. She sends him over. The tribe takes him away from his grandmother, and they send him over to Durango, Colorado, which is where I was teaching school. And he's going to a Native American group home there. He's really lonely and really angry, and he's not doing well at all. Well, he ends up staying that summer to work on the ranch of an old rancher who has a gold mine up in the mountains. And the two of them go up in the mountains where this boy, who has this strong feeling for bears, ends up trying to save the last grizzly bear in Colorado. Now, this is my first book, Bear Stone, but it took me like 6, 7, 8 years to write it over a lot of versions to figure out how to write a story. And it's inspired by a real event. You know, that's the way a lot of my books actually began. And it began with the death of the last grizzly bear in Colorado in real life in 1979. And a bow hunter had thought he had shot a black bear, turned out to be the last grizzly. So I thought maybe I could, I always wanted to write a story, maybe I could write about a boy trying to save the last grizzly bear. And that's where I got started with my first one. And then Bear Stone, all one word, Bear Stone. There's a sequel to it called Bear Dance.
You sometimes carry your characters then from one book to another?
I do. I've done that maybe 3 times. Bear Stone has a sequel, Bear Dance, where the boy's back up in the mountains and he meets the mate and the cubs of what was thought to be the last grizzly bear. And I've got a Grand Canyon novel called Down River that has a sequel called River Thunder. And then the other one of mine that has a sequel is the Klondike story, Jason's Cold, that has the sequel Down the Yukon about the rush to Nome from Dawson City on the heels of the Klondike Gold Rush.
This one comes from, and this is kind of related, Pia in Julie Yates' class. Craig, what is your favorite book you ever have written?
Well, it's kind of a tie. I gotta tell you, for years and years, it was Far North. And that's because my favorite character in all of my books is in Far North, and his name is Johnny Raven. And I hope all my readers listening today, if you haven't read Far North, you got to read Far North. You got to meet Johnny Raven. And this is his message to the young people. Take care of the land. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. But now, as I mentioned, it's a tie, and I have another favorite book of mine. It's funny hearing the author say, well, you got favorite books, but you do. You know, they're all, you like them all, but you got to have a favorite. So now it's a tie, and the other book is Crossing the Wire. Crossing the Wire came out about 4 or 5 years ago, and it's about a boy from central Mexico who's been supporting his mom and his sisters and his little brother ever since his father died in an accident up in the United States. His father was an illegal worker in the United States who had been going back and forth to support his family, send the money home, as so many people from Mexico and Central America do. So this boy, he's now 15. He's been raising corn to support his family ever since his father died. And now the price of corn has collapsed. It's virtually worthless. It doesn't matter how much he grows. He goes to his mother when he finds this out, and he says, Mama, I have to go to El Norte, to the United States, to pick the fruit and harvest the vegetables, to send the money home like Papa used to do. And so this is about a very courageous boy's journey. He doesn't have the knowledge. He has no experience, men to travel with. He starts out with only like $10. And somehow he has to make this dangerous journey. All the things that happen to him or other characters you meet in the story are all things that have happened to people trying to get across the border without documents to find work in the States for the sake of their families. So it's my effort to put a human face on this very complex and controversial subject that we call illegal immigration. That one's Crossing the Wire, and I hope you'll read that one too.
And you're talking to us from Tucson. I find that interesting.
Oh, yeah. Even before, you know, we came down here to spend this winter, you know, living in southwest Colorado for so long, you know, this is southern Arizona is very in very easy reach for us. And it's an amazing environment where these mountain ranges just crop up out of the desert. And there's huge trees growing up on the top of these sky islands. And so I've been hiking in this environment for years and fascinated with the Sonoran Desert, with the plants and the animals. When after 2001, when everything changed on the border and it became so dangerous for the illegal immigrants to come across to find work, and they started dying by the many hundreds in the desert in southern Arizona, I thought I should try to write this story. When I first got out of college back in the early 70s, I had picked fruit for a month with men without documents from Mexico in an orchard in Emmett, Idaho. And these men worked so hard. It was working in the fruit and then working on the fishing boat out of Craig. I tell you, the hardest manual labor that I have done in my life, picking the fruit and cleaning those fish all day long. But I learned the value of hard work first from those men in the orchard in Idaho, and I knew how dedicated they were to their families. And when then people started dying in the desert down in Arizona in those few years after 9/11, I thought, well, some of them are just like the men I was working with. These are really good guys. I got to find out what's going on down there. And that was the impetus for writing Crossing the Wire.
We're talking with Will Hobbs, and he is the Spirit of Reading author this time around. They're in the process of picking the next one right now, as a matter of fact. And there's a bunch of people who have read Will Hobbs's books and have submitted questions and are calling. We lost one. We lost the Valdez call, and we can't seem to get it reestablished, so we need to have them call back. If they're listening in Valdez, call back, and we'll get you hooked up to get you talking with Will Hobbs. Meanwhile, West Homer Elementary is weighing in.
Oh, Homer. Yeah. Oh, along with Sitka, I think those are the two most beautiful towns in the world.
Yeah. So from Sue Brass's sixth grade class at West Homer, if you ever come to West Homer, we would love to meet you and hear your stories from Natasha and Samantha. And Jarrett Johnston says, how many books have you published? Well, that's a big number, isn't it?
Well, it's 20 now with the novel that just came out, Take Me to the River, was my 18th novel. And I have the two picture books for the young readers, really for readers of all ages, but they're illustrated. And one is called Bear Dream that goes kind of a picture book to go along with my two bear novels with the Ute hero and Bear Dream. We've got a native kid. It's a retelling of the story of how the Ute people learned their bear dance from the bears. So that's one of my two picture books. The other one, Howling Hill, is actually set on the exact same river as far north on the South Nahanni River in the Northwest Territories. And it involves the exact same waterfall, that 385-foot waterfall. It's about a little wolf who gets separated from her family. If you ever, think, I can't write a story, I can't think of an idea, you just have a character get separated from their family. It might even be an animal character, like my Howling Hill, or like The Incredible Journey, or it might be a human, it might be a kid who gets lost and tries to find their way back home. Boom, you got a story. So in my story, the little wolf gets separated from her family when she's playing on the log, and she discovers it with her siblings, and now she's the only one on the log, and it's floating down the river, and so she doesn't know what to do. So her family runs along the shore, but they come to a cliff, and so they get stopped, but she floats all night and all day until she hears a mighty roar downstream.
Oops.
She finally musters up her courage. She jumps off the log, swims to the shore. It was that huge waterfall, but now she's way lost, and she has to find her way back home. So you can go on a river, you can see the waterfall, you can get an idea for a book. Incidentally, remember me talking about the plane where the motor died above the falls?
Yeah.
On that same river? I didn't make that up. That happens in my novel, but I didn't make it up. It happened to a bush pilot who brought in these two tourists. I heard it from a park warden there when I was portaging the falls. Starts telling me the story about this incident that happened the summer before when this pilot flew in, the two tourists, just so they could see the falls. He landed out on the river. He meant to go over to the little dock there and tie up, but he never made it. His motor died. His battery went dead. And he actually had the two tourists, just like the boys in my story, get out on the pontoons and try to paddle the airplane to the falls. I mean, to the shore before it went over the fall.
Well, yes.
This happened in real life, and by the way, they made it in the nick of time. They survived.
Wow.
But in my story, we've got to get rid of that airplane. So we're going to get some characters on the shore, but we're going to lose the airplane over the fall.
Well, Timothy Wu in Homer wants to know, do you come to Alaska a lot and fish? And Dylan Renz, a related question, have you hunted?
I grew up fishing with my dad, but not hunting, and I still to this day haven't. I greatly admire, I have a neighbor in Durango who feeds us elk. He gets an elk every fall, and I admire people who hunt and hunt well and respect the animals. But I just grew up fishing, and I'm still crazy about fishing. And I have fished quite a bit in Alaska, not nearly as much as I would like to. You give me an invite, and I'll be up there. But I fished the Alagnak, I already mentioned, three times with family members. And that's been really special because when we were kids growing up at Elmendorf outside of Anchorage, my dad with the Air Force got to go down and fish those huge trophy rainbow trout at Naknak on the Naknak River. And boy, that was his idea of paradise. And so I haven't fished the Naknak River, but the Alagnak is virtually, it's a nearby river in the same area in Bristol Bay. And my dad was gone, but my brother and I are there living the dream. And fishing for the salmon and those big rainbows out there in southwestern Alaska is just right at the top of my list.
I imagine so. We're talking with Will Hobbs, author, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
It's Talk of Alaska. We got a bunch of questions, including Will, who joins the program from Valdez. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Will, and thanks for calling.
Hello?
Hi, Will. What do you want to say to Will Hobbs?
Well, I wanted to say to Will Hobbs, well, we, we wanted to ask Will Hobbs if he ever had the main character in his books as a girl.
Oh, boy. Okay, Will, take that one.
Three of them come to mind right off the bat. You know, I wanted to make sure that some of my books do have a girl as the main character, because I knew, you don't want to write only for the boys, and you don't want to assume that girls are not interested in the outdoors and that they're not interested in adventure. That is false. Girls love those kind of books when they're written well and have a strong emotional quality to them, and they've grown up doing all these same things. For themselves. So, here's that list for you. Let me give you a short list. My book, Downriver. The main character is a girl. She's also the storyteller. Her name is Jessie. That's the story of these seven kids trying to run the Grand Canyon all on their own, seven teenagers. And I decided, well, you know, so many outdoor books, the main character is a boy. Why not have it be a girl who tells the story? Because when we take our own raft down through the Grand Canyon, you know, there are women rowing the boat right next to me and kayaking, and they're, you know, they're doing everything these days, climbing mountains and mountain biking, and you name it. So Jessie is the main character of that story, and she's also the main character of the sequel called River Thunder. So that's Downriver and River Thunder with their girl protagonist. And then also, and I think especially for readers of mine who are a little bit younger, Jackie's Wild Seattle. That's the title of the novel. The main character is a girl named Shannon who rescues wild animals for a wildlife center outside of Seattle, Washington. And there's a lot of adventure in it. And that's the one on the cover. You'll see a girl climbing a cliff. This is on the hardcover, climbing a cliff on the rope with a backpack. And she's got a baby seal, baby harbor seal in the backpack that she has rescued from down the beach. And now she's got to climb get it back up the cliff before the tide comes in. Now, on the paperback, it's got a different cover. But I would definitely recommend that one to you, Jackie's Wild Seattle. So a whole bunch of my other books, you've got girls as characters, but they may not be the main character. But in those three novels, you got the girl as the main character. Also, I made that little wolf who gets lost in Howling Hill. That's a girl wolf. So I should say that's a fourth one.
All right. Hey, Will and Valdez, that was a great question. Thanks for that.
Well, thank you. And Mrs. Craner's class absolutely loved Wild Man Island. And so thank you so much. We really appreciate being able to listen to you today.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. The school librarians are the unsung heroes of our culture. Well, Will Hobbs, when I brought up to one of our interns here, Josh Tucker, I said, we're going to be doing this issue of Juvenile Fiction because we like to promote this idea, and kids get hooked on adventure books. And he said, I was one of those kids. and he wanted to maybe challenge you a little bit. Josh, come on, get on that microphone there.
Hey, Will, how's it going?
Hi, Josh.
Hey, well, I just have a quick question here. You know, I grew up about 15 miles from the nearest gas station, and we didn't have cable TV or any of that, so definitely a lot of reading going on. My parents got me into it, too. And, you know, the ones I remember, I'm 26 now, the ones I remember years later are definitely the classics. And I'm thinking of stuff like The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis and, yeah. You know, Madeline L'Engle, A Wrinkle in Time, A Wind in the Door, A Swiftly Tilting Planet, and even Susan Cooper, the Dark is Rising sequence. And you know, these are, I was thinking about it, and they're all English, or mostly, and they're a little older, and for me, these classics, they have, you know, longer character arcs, they have more philosophy, sometimes theology woven into them, even for kids. And and I wonder, you know, I look at the Harry Potter, and you know, I read all that too, but it didn't have the same depth for me. It didn't, and so I wonder, you know, and I remember bringing this up with my mother, and she says, well, you know, you don't judge the classics judge you. And so I wonder how you feel in you know, with all the classics behind us. And also I see a lot of more contemporary stuff that does have a lot of staying power, like maybe more in your field, like Gary Paulsen, who's done a lot of great writing about the Iditarod and wrote Hatchet and a lot of great survival literature. So I wonder where you see yourself fitting into that, and maybe who you look to as an influence, or as a, what are the classics for you?
Well, there's a lot there to your question. You know, some of those writers that have been mentioned today, like Gene Craighead, George, and Gary Paulsen, just fabulous, fabulous writers. And they write for a little kids. You know, the bullseye is a little bit younger than the kids that I write for. I was a secondary teacher and mostly a, you know, seventh grade teacher. And my stories, my novels tend to be for kids generally a little bit older, and even going up into high school. And the librarians and the teachers are always telling me they give my books to kids who have read Gary Paulsen and read Gene George, and they're saying, now try Will Hobbs. And I think what you'll find that I'm trying to do, I'm trying to write a book with a whole lot of layers that will really appeal to kids who may read quite well, but they don't read anymore because there's not enough meat. There's not enough content, and so I'll give you the one I'd like you to start on with is that book I've mentioned several times called Far North. And you know, rather than just write an outdoor survival story, once I did that research and had learned about what's going on in the native villages and the NWT and all over the north, I realized this can be a story about the survival of the native way of life up in those remote villages, as well as the physical survival way below zero in the middle of winter. So I'm trying to write it, you know, at more than one level with a lot going on. And I do so much research. I think it's very fairly unusual for the young adult field that there's so much content in my books. One one university professor writes about the field says what I do is she would call it info fiction. Hmm. For example, in Leaving Protection, you'll find a lot of amazing history about the Russians in Alaska that a lot of Alaskans haven't run across yet.
Yeah, so that's the impression that I'm getting, Will, is that you're almost, you get excited about your material, and then you're kind of trying to open the door, really.
That's it. I read all these histories of the Russians in Alaska by Hector Shevigny, and working with the historical park there in Sitka and learning about the history of these plaques and about Rezanov's amazing journey from Sitka down into San Francisco Bay.
Yeah.
To try to get food from the Spanish for relief for the Sitka site for Baranov's fort there back in 1804, I think it was. Just amazing stuff, and I'm thinking this would be so cool if kids could learn this stuff in a novel that they would never learn in their classroom. And this is what novels can do. I think a really well-written novel that has a lot of content in it is really get kids excited in an intellectual way.
Here's one from Graham and Mr. McKenna's class that kind of flips over the way we've been talking. First off, he'd like to know if there might be a sequel to Leaving Protection coming up, and he says, if not, what book would you recommend next to kids who loved Leaving Protection?
If they love Leaving Protection, let me think. They might really love the Southeast setting and want to learn more about Southeast Alaska and Wild Man Island. It's just set a little bit north. Wild Man Island is the kid's name for Admiralty, the Fortress of the Bears. And I had done some sea kayaking there to the Stan Price Bear Sanctuary right after having done the 6-day sea kayaking camping trip along the shores of Chichagof. And in that novel, I got all excited about this new theory that the first Americans, first people to come from Asia, didn't come across the land bridge, but they came earlier on skin boats made from the hides of sea mammals stretched over driftwood frames.
Oh, man, you're going to leave us hanging because we got to end the show.
So read that one. Try Wild Man Island next.
All right, Will Hobbs, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's been fabulous. Thank you, everybody.
All right. Thanks thanks to Ginny, as always. Thanks to Dave Waldron at the controls. Jersey Shedlock on the telephone. Josh Tucker, thank you so much.
And is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender, and by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pinair.com.
Indian Trust Land IIM account Indian Trust $3.4 billion settlement Website amun indiantrust.com amun BU Mountain, Hwaltoklogulugu, 1-800-961-6109.
Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.